Says in the Hakdama to Perchelik that a person has to leave the liquor and to go to Amhaba, and it's often understood to be a natural process. They have to attain that intellectual level, otherwise it's inconceivable they attain Amhaba. But in Hilchos Melachim, in Perch Shmini Lachu Yudalef, the Rambam says that non-Jews can go to Amhaba if they keep the Zayin Mitzvah to Bnei Noach because they were commanded to. There's no mention of belief in the Ikarim there. And the second question was, again on the Ikarim, that in relation to what the Rambam writes at the end of Makkos, that a person has to do a mitzvah lishma to attain olam haba, and how that's seen in the context of what he writes in the Hakdama to Perek Chelek, where he seems to say that belief in the Ikarim is a sufficient prerequisite for being to olam haba.
Got what you ask, but Bnei Noach, I don't think the Rambam understood that the Yudgim Likim were intended for them to believe in. There's so much more universal in nature, conceivably he would assume it's part of their acquirement of the Amunah, but the mitzvah, but certainly those which are more specific, the word Moshe Rabbeinu and so on, the Yichud of the word Moshe Rabbeinu, that those are not things I think the Bnei Noach are bound to believe. Maybe some questions to whether the mitzvah of Amunah as such is one which is incumbent upon them as a mitzvah. The fact that it's not counted amongst the seven mitzvahs is no indication. The Gemara says that those mitzvahs deal with Sheva Taisa, the Kuvah say, are not counted. I would assume that the situation for them is similar to what the Bahag assumes is for us in other contexts. And namely, it's not an independent mitzvah, but it's the infrastructure for religious life, which includes the Zayin Mitzvah Bnei Noach and the existence of Bnei Noach in general, that is based on the assumption that exists the Bnei Shalom and Ashgacha, certain universal principles. But these are not as an independent mitzvah. The difference is in terms of the degree of commitment, involvement, and engagement. As far as the other question of the Shema, I don't recall the exact text over there, but I can't imagine that I'm assuming that someone who does things Shalom Lishma is not worthy of entering Olam Haba. What I'm thinking is saying is that the value of doing things Lishma is not simply to add another mitzvah, you have a qualitative dimension which will enhance a person's prospects of getting there, which also determines to some extent one's station once he's there. Olam Haba, that Rambam certainly assumed, is not all of a piece, either you're in or you're out. The different levels, different gradations, depending on a person's status in this world. Then what Rambam says is, in order to attain a nobler station, one should do things lishma. Of course, if he doesn't want to enter Olam Haba, that's a shalom lishma in itself. What I'm saying is not that that should be the motivation, but that should be the result. A number of places the Rambam speaks of prospering to Olam Haba, but I think it's clear that's not the motivation. There'll be shalom lishma in chizdeish, chizchuvah. He speaks of religious life in its totality. Obviously, that's not to be the motivation. This is the process to be undergone, the result of which will be that he will be Zecher Chayyim Abba. And he has similar formulations in other places as well. But someone who leads a life Shalei Lishma It's not optimal, it's not ideal, but I'm certainly new to the Gemara of Tbeis Vitev Shalish Vashti Shalish Mabalishma, and I don't think anyone indicates that someone who doesn't do that doesn't get to Lamabe. Yes.
In the Mishnah Slaviyama, Varan Chavler discusses, especially when with regards to teaching the Avos, the Mice Avos, the Midim, to quote his lesson, he said that when a student asks about a certain behavior characteristic of Avos, as he made clear to them that we're not dealing with Manashim Regulum Bali Egos or Sonos, and that they're Nikiyim, Nikol Shifa, Rotan Asmi, as he made clear that they were dealing with people who were Havyoka like Malachim. The question has to be put into that context, like asking a question on the Avos, like asking a question about a Malach, which you have no understanding. What extent does that have to be the approach taken from
Mahanik? That particular passage I don't know, but the Baron Kotler wrote a whole pamphlet, a brochure, I forget just what the title of it is, about learning the Sefer Breishis, according, I don't remember the exact title of it, it's about Sefer Breishis. This is what you've read, is the fairly standard perception of the Balei HaMusil, the Makot Kevin Slabotke. This totally idealized portrait, a kind of dehumanized presentation, or transhumanized presentation, and the whole literature about the Musa, which is, relates not only to the Ogres, that's where they deal with the Deir HaMidbar, that's where they deal with the Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is more the way things are presented. Anyone who wants to adhere to it can adhere to it. It's clear that Chazal didn't think that way. It's clear that Rishonim didn't think that way. If you open with Rabban al HaTorah, you certainly are not going to get it to be quoted to me. What you then have to do is, if you want to follow this particular tradition, what they did to the others, you then have to do to the Ramban. Clearly the Ramban didn't mean, didn't intend, couldn't have said, because that doesn't square with what the Alba told Ms. Labotki. So obviously it has to be something else. This is an issue which is debated. In Chazal, and Rabban quotes Midrashim, and there are Midrashim which point in the direction that he has. You know, that what was the fight between Ishmael and Yitzchak, what was it about, things of that kind. But the Midrash was pointed the opposite direction. Some of them very daring, even by our standards. It's a much freer environment. Some of the things which have in Midrashim present things in a negative light and for no perceptible reason. What compelled the Chazal to assume that when Yosef came home that day, then what did have relations with Potiphar's wife? Is there anything in the Pesukim which mentions that? Well, what compelled Chazal and the Medrash to say that Dinah fell in love with Shem and she wanted to stay with him? Or to be critical, to say that the Pasha of Dinah occurred because Leah was a Yatzonis. Because in the Pasha of the Dudoyim, she went out to Yaakov. That had certain sexual implications, and therefore, it's happened to Dina. It's not that Rabban Kotler wouldn't say that. You and I wouldn't say that either. There are all kinds of things of that kind. The Gemara says that, quotes a popular saying, sort of proverbial saying, apparently, but to explain, the Pasuk says that this proximity between Pasuk which mentions that Yitzchak got married to Sarah. The next pasuk of Yosef of Mikachisha Shmo Ketura. Most of the Baba Kama that these two are related. It's not just could they happen to be one or the other. And Rashi is no more no less that, that the reason Avraham married Ketura because envious of Yitzchak. So you have things in the Midrash which point in both directions. I have the highest regards for Rabban Kotler, but you know, I come from a different position in this respect. And in a sense, if to speak of others who work differently, the Netziv is not in that particular position. Netziv and Amigdoma throughout speaks very realistically and in very human terms of the others, of others. My own feeling is that certainly we, you know, we don't want to have just what today is called, you know, Tanakh Begovei Naim. That issue has been kicked around the last few years. There was some thunderous blasts out from the direction of Haramo, some in the direction directed towards other yeshivot, some in the direction of some people involved in our yeshiva around this issue. And certainly we don't want to think of the Avos or any of the major figures that we have in Tanakh, the ones which are part of the backbone of our tradition. All kinds of figures in Tanakh which are somewhere limbo. Loit and Eliezer and Avraham and Yishmael and Noach and Yoav, all stupid, rushing back and forth. Some which view them very positively, some which are very, very critical of them. But none of those were limbo, but those were Abdelech HaMelech, Shloimeh, David, Shloimeh, etc., etc. We certainly don't want to view them as being ordinary mortals, as you and I are, and we want to think of them as giants. But the question has to do really with, can giants lapse at all? And secondly, what does it mean to be a giant? So part of the debate around this Kove Einayim business has to do not with how you read certain parts of Tanakh, but what are the underlying assumptions when you approach Tanakh? The reason the people of Rabban Kotler, and I speak with great admiration, that don't be misunderstood, think that you have to read all human emotions out of Sefer Bereishis, because they think that to have human emotions is a failing, it's a fault, it's weakness. If you don't assume that, and you assume that having human emotions is a wonderful thing, even Moshe Rabbeinu, the Rambam says, Nisarish Kim Alochim, but the Midrashim speak constantly of human elements, human emotions, responses, relation to him. If you feel that that is a value and it's, you don't want to dehumanize people, you don't think that what is greater for having no human emotions, which has to do even with individual part of it. How do you envision the Akedah? Now, what you're talking about, what passage you quoted, envisions the Akedah, probably like one of the Swiss guards outside Buckingham Palace, outside the Vatican. Namely, Avraham Avinu goes to shecht the sun, as if he was going to shecht the regular oil and regular kolben, with great joy that he's being able to Rabbeinu Shleilam. To paraphrase it, Nathan Hale, his only regret is that he only has one son to give for the Rabbeinu Shleilam. That's the way it's portrayed. But the Rashim don't speak that way. The Rashim say that the white Avraham Yitzchak later on suffered, his vision was poor. At the time of the Akedah, Avraham wept, and the tears entered Yitzchak's eyes, and that's what affected him. It's a wonderful medrash by Yitzchak, a wonderful medrash by Avraham. But there's no room for a medrash of that kind in what you're quoting. I grant you that people like myself and ourselves, the Rav and the Tziv, you know, an old tradition, are in a more difficult situation. If you totally dehumanize Sefer Bereishit, it's easier to learn it. You don't have to cope with all kinds of problematic issues. Some problematic parshas, sibling rivalry, and things of that kind. That's on the one hand. The other hand, if you take a totally naturalistic view, which is what one asks for biblical criticism. Biblical criticism is not just tearing apart the text, it's tearing apart the people who are in the text. And when biblical criticism first began to sprout wings in the mid-19th century, that was one of the elements. A fellow named Milman wrote a whole book, it's Avraham Avinu, you talk about just an Arab sheik, and that's it. People speak in that vein also have no problem. They approach characters in Tanakh as if they were reading the Iliad and the Odyssey. If you take a balanced approach, it's more complex, it's more subtle, it's more difficult. And at times it makes, one wants to have a view of obviously Moses' giants. So number one, you say giants, but with a lapse. Maybe that's a little painful. You know, maybe you would prefer that without a lapse. But it's also more complex because you don't go to one of the extremes. Now I speak of the Ramban in this respect because the Ramban is the foremost champion of this kind that we learn in children called moral realism. And it comes through various parshas. Go through Sefer Bereishit with the Ramban. Take a look at how he relates and how Rashi relates. For instance, to Rocha's complaint. So if you read Rashi, it's very idealized, and she wanted to have part of the mitzvah be made of Klal Yisrael, etc., etc. Ramban says she spoke to a petulant young woman who was frustrated and envious. Oh, we heard the whole parsha of Yosef and the brothers. And Amma says some very remarkable things over there. He says that the reason they brought the Kutsiris Pasim to Yaakov, because they knew that Yaakov, if they didn't bring some proof as to what had happened, that Yaakov would suspect they had killed him. Take the Pasha Brachas and Pasha Tildes. In the Ramban, there's real feeling, real sympathy for Esav. When Esav begins to cry, the Ramban feels for him. In Rashi, Esav is black as a pole in every respect. So, it's a question which tradition one finds itself in. Which is part, let's say, a tradition of interpretation, the hermeneutics tradition, but it's partly also a moral tradition. How do you relate to human feelings? Is all feeling a weakness, or it's part of one's humanity, part of human greatness? But the Ramban Kotel is not alone. I tell you to quote Rabbi Isaac Sher, who was Mashgiach in Chevron, and he would speak about Esav coming with Arba Meres Ishimoi, And he said, was, das sind immer 400 Soldaten, das sind immer 400 Rosh Hashivas. He said, was, wasn't 400 soldiers, 40 Rosh Hashivas. And that way you theorize everything and you wipe out so much. Yes.
Did you tell us the basic sources about the teeth of the fed, the desire, the fire, and so forth? And what seemed earlier going on in the search for?
I don't remember all the basic sources, let me put it this way, but the central element as to what the Gemara says that Hayumna de Lemayat Sakinale is endangering the Tinik. And having Mitzitza Bepeh is pretty widespread. Abchaim abolished it. The priest was not Mitzitza Bepeh. There are two versions. They don't contradict each other, but one version, which I heard from someone who would be close to the story, said there was an incident of a child, and the infant died. And that was it. The Lomdish side of it, which the Rav used to quote, was that the Gemara doesn't say Mitzitza is part of the is a mitzvah. Must have mitzitzes needed for, as a medical precaution. So if we now have better ways to avoid infections and whatnot, on the contrary, maybe the infections will be solved. So it's not necessary. This is in effect today is in Chidushim, not the Chidushim of the Ran proper, but those which are ascribed to the Ran. There's a list of things which are Lecha Shabbos in Mila. What's Lecha Shabbos? The actual Mila, the Priya, etc. etc. So it all looks. It says that if a person has begun, can he continue? He's begun the Mila, but it's, if it's sits in Shadim Akbinis of Mila, he continue cutting until he gets all those little strands which are around for the olive. The person has cut, but the little strands, so if there's so many strands which most of the Torah is still covered. So it's a continue. But what if this is Shemak Misa Miller? So if Piresh, if he had interrupted, he finished the Miller, he said, it doesn't go back. But the Bechayel of Shabbos belongs among the Shemim. If like Piresh, then he can continue. What is Piresh? What is like Piresh? So yeah, he raised the question, what if he's done everything, but the Mesitzi hasn't done yet? So he's still assumed to be in the process of the Miller or not? So he says, "Mistaber d'chol nushim mitasim b'tzurchei mila kon chatichata u'priyata u'mitzitzata lo mikre pirash d'kulu tzurch mila ninu." Rim silek yadav achal mikain after the finished the mitzitza, haynu pirash ap mishadei yeshu liten esplani tzuchmon. He still has to put a bandage on it and so on. So that's considered he's finished the Mila. This is just medical precaution. Then he says, "V'afilu b'mitzitza atzma yesh la'ayin d'chol shepara ha'isiyem tzrachei Mila v'dilma mitzitza mikri refuah ולא צורך מילה היא, צריך יהיו. This is a suffix. Now, what's clear is that, I don't know whether Reb Chaim had access to this, that everybody knew this, but that's what Rav told me. He didn't, Rav, I don't know if Rav knew this either, Chushan, but some of his father that he was normally using. But that's the where the issue turns. Now, there's some people who feel that even if it's not something which is halachically necessary, but it's advisable, you wouldn't cut out having kvatels, but making the mishaberechs, the kelly osenu, so you wouldn't cut this out either. It's a question of where you relate to the minhagi. So that's on the one side. The other side, you have to see, ask yourself how you relate to do the mitzitzin. Do you assume that might entail certain dangers? It's a big tumult, as I suppose you heard with Rav Tendler now in the States, about this issue. There was a whole story that he's not fighting it. That's what I was told. It's all a hearsay when I got it. He's gone to court, he wants to stop. Stop the mitzitza because there's some story with his eggs, I don't know with what, with some, or something dangerous. If there's no reason to stop it, it's one thing, but if there's a chash, even a remote one, I can understand very well the position which he's taking. I presume there's some literature about this, but I don't know. The basic source of what I told you. Sholoch, he's also Mezitzin, etc., as you have in the Gemara, but what its status is, and therefore what the implications would be in our situation, I don't know. But our first three children were born in the first three boys born in the States, and the love was there, and he's like a hawk to be sure there should be no Mezitzin. Neither prepared nor, some of them used this glass straw. He was there to be sure to be nothing of anything. Our youngest son was born here, so the male did what he wanted.
Which
was? It's the best of my recollection. He did the mitzvah. I don't remember the pair with the straw, I don't recall. It was Yasala, but I don't remember. But I assume that he did. What did you say?
In Israel, the Baal Ma'olim
do mitzitzah prepare? They don't all do mitzitzah prepare, but I think they generally do mitzitzah. The many use this glass straw to do mitzitzah. And not a direct contact with the baby. I don't think there are direct practical ramifications, ordinarily speaking. The question is how a person relates to the mitzvah as such, the zocher, what that implies in terms of the implacable hatred for evil, for the incarnation of evil. That is part of it, and that's of course the kriya is a mitzvah, whether the kriya sater is midrash or not, but it's a mitzvah. The Rav once spoke about this in two different contexts, different occasions, but with the same general application. And some people, for obvious reasons, are fastened upon what he wrote. My recollection was in 1954, I was not in New York, I was in Boston, but I heard a tape. The Rav spoke from the Mizrahi Convention. He was vehemently opposed to taking German reparations. Vehemently opposed. And he spoke to that effect in that speech. And he quoted the name of Reb Chaim So a molag is nishkir asinfot. A molag is not a particular ethnic group. A molag is whichever group dedicates itself, commits itself to eradicating Yahadus, that is a molag. I don't know to what extent he would have assumed the flip side of that. The flip side being that a molag, people who are ethnically a molag, but who do, for whom this is not part of their agenda, are not included. But this much he mentioned. And therefore he thought that taking the reparations was shlala molag. Shlala molag is us. And he said this. Subsequently, so that, I don't know how many people know about that, but there's a footnote. I think it's a footnote. He called the Dito fake, which repeats this. This is not with the Germans, but with regard to the Arabs. And this, of course, for some people who do not ordinarily quote the Hof, is a gold find, gold mine. He never spoke of applying that practice to the Arabs, but he spoke again of, you know, of the hatred for us, etc. But beyond that, I can't tell you.
Very often, the Gemara, in order to resolve a kasha or a stira, the Gemara brings the kimta, and it's very often a rare, far-fetched case. The interpretation of the Mishnah has a rare case. Are we always necessary to believe that that was the original intention of the author of the Mishnah, the rest of whoever it was? And if it wasn't, then are there any implications?
I don't think that's what the Gemara intends when it has an akimte. And I think Hashem took that into consideration. In many cases, with Machlokes the Gemara, they ask kashi after kashi, and it's warded off by some kimte. When Hashem came to Paschal on which one of the 2 days, they will say, you don't Paschal this, because even though he answered all the kashi, but she knew the chiki, and therefore we Paschal against them, we Paschal them. What I presume that implies is that we're not getting involved in the question of what the original intent was. We're dealing with the text of the text. What we're saying is that it is conceivable to ward off a kasha, to relieve an apparent contradiction, if we assume such and such. So it could very well be a bit of an escape hatch in order to resolve the possible contradiction. That's what I think Mishen intended when they spoke of Shemini Dechiki, because the Pashas is not like that. In certain cases, I think it's true that even with the Shemini Dechiki, we do Paskin. But you have in some instances a certain tension between the raw text and reason, logical principles as opposed to textual ones, and how the balance is struck, in which direction do you tilt? Right to that, there's some differences between Bavli and Yerushalmi, some differences later on between the Mesir of Chachm Isfar and Chachm Ashkenaz. How far you go with that? But that to some extent, where it must suggest that we can take that as being a reasonable way of disposing of a particular contradiction, that is there. The issue which you raise, I don't think it's explicitly noted in the Gemara. Says it could be such and such.
This might be a weird question, but can the Rav maybe just talk about some of the highlights of his opinion about stem cell research, maybe some of the issues, or if it is an issue, the benefits? Questions?
I just know, you know, when I read newspapers, which is not very much, that was a few years ago. As far as, again, speaking out of the ignorance, which is also a few years ago, I didn't understand at the time what should be the problem for us from our point of view. If one assumes, and maybe the difference of opinion of our doctors about these issues, but if what I understood at the time was that it was entirely conceivable that stem cell research would lead to saving of lives, and the question then had to do as to whether one would dispose of certain cells, etc., in order to do that, certainly mutar l'mitzvah rabbah. I don't know what, you know, what the considerations were. I think the American government have some reservations about it. I don't know for what reasons, whether they thought that it was too experimental, whether they thought that you had the moral right to destroy some cells so to save someone else. I don't know, but as far as I can see at the time, certainly should be not only permissible but encouraged.
One of the opinions that I've heard is that it could be a problem is that the way that they have the way they get the cells out of time is from abortuses, which for health reasons to get benefit from for to save lives would be okay, but they raise the possibility that if they keep doing this research in the future, it could lead to people having a better view of abortion because at least the abortus will do the research. So some people were against. I mean, you know, Jewish sources against because it may lead to the further acceptance. Is that an issue that Rav Kunzin thinks is an issue, or is that really a valid concern? Because right now it's not really done like that. But the question is,
if indeed the prospect of saving lives is significant, I don't think that one has a right to say because he thinks that people will be encouraged at some level to undergo abortions, therefore other people meanwhile should die because he's afraid of this. Now, part of this has to do, of course, for the issue, admittedly a bit of a sticky one, of the Reb Yehuda, you know, when we define as Pekuach Nefesh, you need Chelel Lefaneinu. The Reb Yehuda assumed that, otherwise they had a self. But no one thinks of these terms today, and it doesn't make any sense today. If the Reb Yehuda's times, Chelel Lefaneinu meant you have to have someone in Prague whose life was going to be saved by undergoing a certain procedure, by whatever you could discover from many kind of post-mortem procedures, maybe it made sense at the time, but today, flow of communication such, anything which happens in Buenos Aires is known the next day in Bombay. In that respect, certainly the world is like a big village, and it's always the Fanei. I haven't heard of anyone who thought that stem cell solutions would help him who turned it down.
In the same order, what's the Rav's opinion about quoting a organ donor card?
There are two separate issues here. One has to do with how what one assumes might happen, under what circumstance, or how do one defines death. Is there a danger that they'll take out vital organs, hastening death, or not? The other is, some people just feel that it's wrong and it's improper and it's mutilation, etc., etc. Back to the first issue, some of the most vital organs, heart, lungs, etc., unless they get them almost while the person is still alive, not much use for them. Then it's a question of how one defines if a person is still alive. You know, the brain death, as opposed to cardiac death issue. In the States, was fought out, it's still being fought out to some extent. Rav Tendler, back in the 60s, convinced Moshe Feinstein, his father-in-law, to come out strongly against the heart transplants. Moshe wrote a tshuva then saying that it was double murder, because you were killing the person who took out the heart, killing the person to whom he put the heart, because he took out his good heart, or whatever his heart he had, and gave another heart because people were dying pretty soon afterwards. I don't know if Fellow of Tendler subscribed that opinion, but by the 80s, he was a vigorous champion of heart transplants, and etc. And much of that was based on the assumption once there's brain death, the person is dead, and therefore, on the one hand, it's permissible to remove vital organs because you can define him as dead. On the other hand, since biologically he's not dead, his heart is still beating, etc., you could still make good use of the organs. Rabban Soloveitchik, your Rebbe as well as mine, was vehemently opposed to this. He held firm to the notion that only cardiac death, nothing short of that. And the issue reached these shores as well. The Avrut Rashid, in principle, adopted Rav Tendler's position with all kinds of safeguards. That it'd be 12 hours after the brain death set in, could be done right away, etc. But in principle, they accepted brain death. Rav Yashiv, I understand, rejected that. What Rav Shlomo Zalman held, you get different versions. He said he was not ready to go along with Rav Tendler. Rav Tendler's son-in-law, Shaftir Rappaport, went to Shlomo Zalman and he conducted an experiment. He took a sheep, beheaded it, and still, which certainly is dead, halachically, by those standards, and still there was some cardiac motion. So he said to him, you see that this is not, that this is the cardiac movement, it's pirkus, etc., it's not, doesn't mean very much. And Rosh Hashanah wasn't convinced, although he sort of left, what he wrote, left a bit of an opening. Maybe at this point medical science is not sufficiently advanced, at some point in the future babies will be, in order to define more specifically. But if one can overcome that particular concern, the second one is certainly of no significance. I once said to a person that said it's mamish chesod and emunah and irrationality. If you believe that chisa basically will get up, it will be missing a leg. If you believe that Beis Shalem can revive you from ashes, dust and ashes, but you don't believe they can revive you with both legs, it's ridiculous.
So practically,
shouldn't it be
really
hard to,
because it's
my book,
or whatever,
a lot
of carrot or whatever, that
some... I can't tell you practically what I... I had a Maisa Shoya at the yeshiva 2 years ago. One of our Tamidim, British boy, was in a bus, was blown up in Tel Aviv. It's between him, Kippur and the Sukkot. And it was pretty clear it was not going to survive. This happened in the afternoon, but in the afternoon of the evening I got a phone call, and I understood this is one of the issues. I went to the hospital in Tel Aviv, spoke to the family, and I said to them, listen, whether or not brain death is or not, etc. So it's different views on Paiskin. I'm not going to pass them for you. Decide, which you want to follow. But independently of that, Told him I thought it was a mitzvah habit to donate his organs. I spent a lot of time there, spoke to a number of doctors back and forth. I called some doctors here. So there were some questions of what some tests some of the doctors thought should be run. At the end, I left about 1 o'clock in the morning, and after having spoken to them, I called again in the morning at 6 or 7, and apparently they had decided to go ahead with it, which they did. Now, I can't tell you this is any definitive. What they were speaking, of course, the weight of Shlomo Zalman's opinion of Joshua's has to be very, very dominant. But on the other hand, it is suffering from Pekuach Nefesh with an imbalance of Pekuach Nefesh. Pekuach Nefesh for the person who's Mamash Agaisis is in one plane, and there it's a question of saving a life which could continue for decades. But the problem is not just Pekuach Nefesh, because that should be a question of triage, who you're looking to save. The problem is much more than that. It's a problem of Tzichi as opposed to Pekuach Nefesh, and that certainly is going to be matter. So it's an always simple issue, but I don't know, if a case came to me again, I think I would do the same thing. Yes?
The reason that same address, there's a lot of talk recently about Shem Daf Yomi. I'm learning that every day. So if a person has to choose between thoroughly doing Daf Yomi with Chazara versus and perhaps having a Mekiyos Tumas Shas, as opposed to learning the Iyun, but at the expense of not necessarily able to have any Mustafa, which would be the wise choice?
Someone told me at the recent Siyum HaShas in New York, one of the people who spoke, one of the Rashivs who spoke, mentioned that the Sanjid Afyemi was made for Balabati. And some of the, I don't know, some of the people who were attending, or some of the Rashivs were a little insulted, where they thought it was not really proper. People are coming to celebrate, to tell them that they're only second-class citizens. But broadly speaking, that's where we attend by Meir Shapiro. Your question is partly the question that's the Daf Yomi, but the Iyun is supposed to be Pekiyus. Chazal recognize the distinction between Iyun and Pekiyus. By and large, I think they would have felt that person when he's very young should get a lot of kiyas, that was the assumption, and then move it to you subsequently. That's not the way things have been done for the last 1,000 years, but that's the way they tended. The result is that what we have today, certainly with the Haredi world, the situation is much better, but within the Arab world, an imbalance, people start plunging into Iyun when the gaps in their knowledge are enormous. And they have to do two things at the same time, try to broaden the base of their knowledge and develop their skills, develop their commitment, develop their engagement, existentially speaking, with learning. I don't know that, you know, depending on how much time you would have to assign to it, if I would advise you to close the gap, the Pekiyus gap, that's it with Daf Yomi. I think it's important, and certainly we encourage people at our yeshiva, similar yeshivas, to do so, to work on both the Pekiyus and the Iyun front. I don't think I would encourage you to learn only the Iyun, unless you know more than you probably do know, or more than I think you probably know. I wouldn't encourage you to give up on that. But the Daf Yomi, I think it's good for some people to do it at one point in their lives, but ordinarily speaking, people with the formative years, when they're learning yeshivas, I don't know whether that's the maximum benefit. For some people, it's very good. I mentioned about Soloveitchik before. There was a Siyum HaShas in Beit Shemesh recently, which his son, who's in Beit Shemesh, spoke. He told the following story. that Rabban suffered a stroke about 16 or 17 years before he died. And at the time he first suffered the stroke, it was a very serious one. There was concern as to whether he'd be able to continue functioning. When he first made the snap out of the stroke, he called one of his sons, asked him to bring him a Gemara Shabbos. Couldn't say why he needs Gemara Shabbos. So he says, well, so they asked him. He said, well, the doctors explained to him he won't be able to go back to function as he's been functioning at the yeshiva. So he said, as long as he was at the yeshiva, was learning B'iyun, so that was his learning. But now he says, no longer be Rosh Yeshiva, be Balabas. Balabas has to learn Daf Yomi. Yes.
It's a common phenomenon nowadays that those on the more progressive end of Orthodox Judaism have shuls or minyanim, which are semi-egalitarian. They have the aliyahs, one of the Zimra, a couple of Shabbos, Mahuli. How should one relate to that phenomenon? Is this, another interpretation of halacha, which maybe is not my personal practice, or is this, is this due for the treatment the Rav gave a shul without mechitza? I mean, one shouldn't go there in shul for Rosh Hashanah. Something in between.
The issue of the Rav with the mechitza was very, very, they went to a very sharp stand that he said better to forego Kiyas Shofar than daven in his shul with mixed pews. I'm not sure the Rav would have passed that today. That time was given in the 50s when many people had the perception that mixed seating in the shul, that was the oxygen sign of our time. And that was pretty much what the Rav felt. He felt that he was holding the fort and holding the line on maintaining the tradition of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, which could be wiped out. He was very much concerned about the Protestantization of Yiddishkeit, which you had in the former conservative movements, and some of the more quote-unquote neo-modern Orthodox movements. And he took a very decidedly very, very sharp stance. I'm not sure he would take that stance today. But if you ask me, let's forget about that particular stance. How do we regard these places? Anyone who asks me, I'm certainly discouraged very much from going there. There are two problematic elements. One is the element, some of the issues themselves, which are right counter to Maseret Yisrael, which affect Kedushas Beis HaKnesses, which to some extent also the impact, the result of the impact of extraneous influences. But over and above that, I have a very serious problem with the underlying attitude which many of these tendencies, upon which many of these tendencies are based. The underlying attitude is that whatever is not explicitly asr is mutar. And you can do it. And if you want, you just go ahead and do it. That is the view of halacha, which I think is much too narrow for our perception. It wipes out midas chesedus, wipes out klum shor hasadin, it wipes out many things which these liberal people claim that they're all in favor of. But that's the underlying basis. You have to show them siv shuronor, which says that it can't be done. Otherwise, they think it can be done, and maybe they think that it should be done. I don't think I could categorically tell a person, don't need Kiyas Shofar, go there. First test is better than Bichidus? I would say yes. Yes.
Regarding the one who already has a background, at least in Kiyas within Tanakh, and is well involved in Talmud Torah, is there a standard that constitutes a proper balance at that point for time management from Gemara and Torah Shabbat, as well as somewhat in-depth study of Tanakh at that point.
So there's no uniform time management. There's no uniform formula. I think what we want and expect is that everyone should have a certain base. Beyond that base, there's room for branching out for some major specialization. To tell you at which point in one's life that should be done, be presumptuous on my part. Their personal needs, their public needs. I think it's clear we need people who are on the one hand Talmidei Chachamim, on the other hand people who know Tanakh well, can handle the issues, can handle the problems. We need those for our own enlightenment, and we need them for Asbara and so on. Should fellows who are in yeshiva, when they're just fresh out of high school, be doing that? Probably not. The fundamental, the staple of the Torah, the level of Iyun, once the basic fundamental basis is in place, is Torah Shebaal Peh. And I think that in the yeshiva, that's what should be maintained. Without getting involved in some of the difficulties, but min b'nechmin egoyin means, so there's some shir who learn, it means philosophy, some say it means Tanakh, and the concern being partly of the issue that was raised before, people who are in Tanakh, that it's pretty steep to shir shabal peh, we begin to read everything literally, and we want Tanakh to be learned, to be read, and to be interpreted and perceived through the prism of Chazal, for all that entails. But to tell you whether a person should be devoting X hours, or half, X over 2, or 2X, and whether he should be doing that in his first year in yeshiva, his fifth year in yeshiva, I don't think I would, I could or would want to give a single formula for that. The primary emphasis, I've indicated, I think should be on learning Torah Shebaal Peh, but on the other hand, what has prevailed for centuries in the Torah world, the Yeshivish world, where it's not that there was a balance between Tanakh and Torah Shebaal Peh, there was almost no Tanakh being learned, that certainly is not something which is desirable, and in that respect, there's been a healthy corrective here and now. All right, we'll finish with you.
How do you feel towards people learning Torah participating in fast days?
People learning Torah what?
People in yeshiva participating in the fast day on Thursday.
I didn't see your question properly, I'm sorry.
How does the Rav feel about people in yeshivas participating in the fast day this Thursday?
In the fast day this coming Thursday?
Yeah.
Happen to be, well, first of all, it's not a fast. The Torah fast half a day, which is what the Gemara calls Tzivu Ba'alma. So that's the Pidi, not a Tzom, and it's not Tadishoyis. Even Tadishoyis, according to the Torah of the Rambam, is the second half of the day. For the size that I saw the first half of the day. If a person feels that, number one, genuinely pained about the issue, and if he feels that this will be proper expression, I will tell him to do as he understands. If a person is fasting because people to the right of him and the left of him are fasting, and he's embarrassed to be thought as being soft on Shnat Yisrael HaShleima, I wouldn't encourage that at all. Part of it has to do with attitudes of Tanaisim in general. The Briska world, the Lithuanian world, was not very keen on that. So I just happened to be leafing through recently an index, a table of contents, and one of the volumes of the Stipulous Letters, and he has a line there, Yafa she'acha b'tamud Torah mi'alef taniyot. First I was a little shocked that a mamus of the Gemara, which says that 1 hour of learning is, 1 day of learning for David HaMelech is more valuable than 1,000 korbanos. So I thought maybe that was in the same spirit. So if you ask me, am I going to tell people in the yeshiva, am I going to fast? The answer is no. Am I going to tell people in the yeshiva to fast? The answer is also no. But I discourage someone who wants to fast. If you're fasting, there's an inyan of Bistana in order to identify with the Unes Tzala. And unquestionably, whether it's good for the country as a whole is unclear. It's not perceived as being good for the people who live there. That is pretty clear. And I feel for their pain. I think that the campaign they're running is going downhill all the time. And they started on high ground. And some is not them, but what they did yesterday was out of their minds, Pasha Mashur. The 10% of the country that is sympathy for them want to alienate that 10% too. Simply senseless. But their pain is real and their concerns are real, both at a personal plane and an ideological plane. And a person who wants to, the tzibur is bitzavo, and at least that tzibur is certainly bitzavo, even if one assumes that it's good for the country, it's always, I say again, I'm not certain of. A person wants to fast, let him fast. I'm not going to give any directives. Do what your heart, what your conscience tells you. If you ask me, if it's disruptive of Talmud Torah, and you won't be able to concentrate upon your learning, I don't imagine that should be the case. Imagine any day you skip breakfast, and by the time you turn around, half the day is gone, and your mind is hopefully fully clear. But I think it's certainly wrong to be insensitive to the struggle these people are waging and to the anxiety they're undergoing. But does that mean that every time that one of the rabbanim decides that you have to have this, you have to have that? Then I think not. So give some thought also to what it might potentially be some of the religious implications of the whole campaign that's being waged. There are people who are concerned, there are serious people, including people who are very keen on Yisrael HaShlema, who think that potentially if the Sinatkut goes through, the effect might be devastating for a lot of young religious kids. It's to be thought about. All right.
What's the wear for Davin? In terms of wearing, dressing the smartly for Davin. In this country, it's not.
We should do it essentially at all. We should dress in accordance with the considered proper dress that people would appear in front of important people. Has negative sides, like barefoot without socks. But the positive side, to need to wear, you need always to daven as if you were in your Shabbos day best. No one does that. And ties in the borderline case in this respect. On occasion, I imagine you would do it, but met a group of English boys at the yeshiva not long ago, and I met one of them and asked some questions. One of them said, I wanted to know, he said, he sees that Rosh Yeshiva and I yeshiva wear hats when they daven. The Bachim don't wear them. Why do the Bachim do what the Rabbein do? I told the Bachim were doing exactly what the Rabbein do. The Rabbein were brought up in a culture where you wore hats. They wear hats. They brought up in a culture where you don't wear hats. They don't wear hats.
That was not an even-handed way of asking that question.
What?